From London, BBC Caribbean Report.
The Commonwealth is told to take a harder line against countries with poor human rights records. Liat workers to come up with an alternative rescue plan, and the warm tributes continue for the late cricketer Malcolm Marshall. I'm Oren Gordon, and this is BBC Caribbean Report. The Commonwealth is being told to take action against its member countries that have poor records on human rights. They include Zimbabwe, Zambia, Kenya, and Sri Lanka. The group has already taken a hard line against military governments, first in Nigeria, now in Pakistan. The man who seized power there, General Pervez Musharraf, has been told that he can't attend the summit in Durban in South Africa later this week. But as Emma Joseph reports, an influential British think tank wants the Commonwealth to go further.
The report by the Foreign Policy Center has called on the Commonwealth to take tougher action against what it calls abuses of democracy. Mark Leonard is the organization's director.
There are four countries. Zimbabwe, for instance, should make progress on elections and on respecting opposition rights. Zambia should also make progress in that area. That Kenya should start respecting the rights of minorities more. And that Sri Lanka has got some important questions to answer on press freedom.
The report has been timed to be released during the summit on Friday when foreign ministers meet. Although it calls for a more consolidated approach to countries that abuse human rights, it falls short of calling for the immediate expulsion of the four named countries. Instead, it has suggested that a deadline be set for the recommended reforms to take place. Mark Leonard again.
We're saying that what we need to do is to be much clearer about what our values are and put in place action plans for countries that are struggling to meet them. And if they haven't met them by 2003, then they have to face suspension.
The report touches on a number of other issues as well. It questions whether Prince Charles should take over as head of the Commonwealth when he replaces the Queen, and whether its headquarters should remain in London. It says that the Commonwealth has the opportunity to define a meaningful role for itself as we enter the new millennium. But in order for that to happen, it will have to think, organize itself, and act differently.
Emma Joseph reporting. So should the Commonwealth be pressuring member countries like Zimbabwe to show more respect for human rights? That's a notion I ran by the former Prime Minister of Dominica, Dame Eugenia Charles, and one with which she agrees.
You belong to an organization, and there's certain understandings by which this organization is run and by its members should run their affairs, so that the Commonwealth would have the right to say to a country, and when they meet, they meet together either in foreign affairs or in general the annual meeting that they have, the biannual meeting they have, they should be able to say, we do not like the fact that this particular country has not encouraged the people of the country to exercise the democratic right of choosing their government. I don't go so far as to say they should expel them right away, but they have a right to criticize that they're not following the policies which the Commonwealth would want to see among all its members.
Can the Commonwealth be accused of interfering?
I don't think so, because I think that you belong to the organization and you belong to it on the basis that you are a democratic country. If they don't have the right to criticize, if they don't have the right to discuss it with the members and to find fault with things they think that are not democratic, then they might as well shut down the Commonwealth and forget it and not let it exist anymore.
We'll be hearing more from Dame Eugenia a little later. Meanwhile, the Commonwealth's largest country, Australia, has voted to keep the Queen as their head of state. In a referendum at the weekend, just over half the voters said no to becoming a republic with the president chosen by legislators. Polls indicated that three-quarters of Australians support a republic in principle. I asked the London-based Australian journalist Michael Dodd whether there had been a collective failure of nerve in the polling booth.
No, I don't think it was. Australians hate politicians with a vengeance. They like the idea of having a president. They actually like the idea of being a republic by and large, despite the fact there are some monarchists left. But most people said, we want to directly elect the president ourselves. We don't want to have the politicians in Canberra choosing the president for us. And under the model that was put up, the politicians in Canberra would have had to have agreed amongst themselves who was the president. and the people being ferociously democratic thought that that wasn't good enough, and many of them are hoping that the question will be put at a future referendum and that they'll be able to vote on the model that they would like.
But don't they care how it looks to the outside world, as if they're all pro-monarchist? And some people would say, why not vote for the model of a republic that was put up, however imperfect it may be?
I personally think that was it's a very sensible approach. Better to have some kind of republic, even if it's not quite what you want, than not to have one at all. The majority of Australians disagree with me. I'm probably particularly sensitive living here in London to how Australia looks on the international stage over this, and quite frankly, I think we do look a little bit silly for the reasons that you suggested in your question. I suppose Australia is somewhat isolated from the world in some parts in particular. If you're in outback Queensland or Western Australia, I suppose you're not particularly in tune with how the country looks from afar. And they were just concerned about getting the republic they wanted, and they'd took the view that we'd rather not have one at all if we can't get a direct say.
Australia will be going to the Commonwealth Summit in Durban this weekend, and they'll be sitting down with small Caribbean countries like Dominica and Trinidad and Tobago that have had the self-confidence to say, we don't want the monarchy representing us any longer.
Yeah, Australia ought to feel a little bit uncomfortable. I mean, I think John Howard, the Prime Minister, who was advocating a no vote, has come out of this in the short term looking successful, but in the longer term, I think he's going to look rather backward-looking at the turn of the new millennium, and I think the country is going to looking a bit like that as well.
Michael Dodd, an Australian correspondent based in London. Dominica's Dame Eugenia Charles told me that it's perfectly understandable that Australians should reject the Republican model on offer.
When we became independent, we decided to go, and it was a decision of the party I belong to, that we should become a republic. We had reasons for it. We knew that if we didn't do it then, that the government that was in power would do it later on, and we would not have, the citizens would have had no chance to talk on it. They would just have been put upon them. But I think it's important that, again, that the citizens should be able to choose whatever is to be used for them, for government.
We were talking earlier about the Commonwealth standing up for norms of democracy, but the Queen is unelected and she's head of the Commonwealth.
The unelected leaders have not had the approval of the citizens of the country.
But nobody in Britain or the Commonwealth elected Queen Elizabeth.
No, but they all have accepted that she's the head and they want her to be the head. There's no doubt at all about that. I think the Commonwealth wouldn't exist if we didn't have the Queen, quite frankly. I don't think any of the countries would really be interested in being in the Commonwealth if it wasn't that we had the Queen as head of the Commonwealth.
Why not?
But they prefer, and this is a choice, I think, of most citizens in the Commonwealth, that they like the Commonwealth because, in fact, the Queen is head of the Commonwealth.
The Commonwealth, Dame Eugenia, projects itself as a forward-looking organization. Isn't it somewhat anachronistic to have the Queen of Britain as head as
no.
It heads towards the 21st century?
I know, because all of us have started off from being part of Great Britain. With all our political institutions have come as a result of our being part of Great Britain.
Some people listening to this discussion we're having will think it's strange that you're backing the Queen to remain head of the Commonwealth while you and Dominica so long ago elected to replace her.
We didn't replace her. We have still kept her as head of the Commonwealth. We have.
But as your head of state.
But we have agreed to have a head of state elected by our parliament.
What does the Queen bring to the Commonwealth that another person, another head, could not?
Because of the position she holds, she is not biased towards any particular thing. She's broad-minded on these things. She listens to all sides. She makes up her mind on what she's told by all sides. She doesn't interfere in the way in which each country runs their business. That is their business. They can do it in the way they want. But when it comes to general things that the Commonwealth is interested in looking at and in doing perhaps in unison, then she comes in as the head of the Commonwealth.
But who's to say, Dame Eugenia, that the Archbishop of Bridgetown wouldn't perform that role in exactly the same way if he was head of the Commonwealth?
I'm not saying he wouldn't, but we already have the Queen and we want to keep it. We don't want to change.
Dame Eugenia Charles, you're listening to BBC Caribbean Report. Workers for the airline Liat are considering a less painful alternative to the recommendations of the consultancy firm Speedwing on how to turn around the debt-ridden airline. Liat is a vital link for the countries of the Eastern Caribbean. It's run up annual operating losses of $13 million EC and owes Caribbean governments millions more. The company has recommended significant job cuts and a reduction to its fleet and operations. Ken Richards reports.
Liat workers who are being allowed to advance their plans for saving the financially strapped airline are keeping a tight lead on what they'll propose to the company's chief executive officer at a meeting this Wednesday. But it is clear they're trying to counter a Speedwing report seen to be proposing drastic measures to take Liat into the realm of profitability. If the Speedwing recommendations are followed, as many as 200 jobs could be cut. It's not a measure which has the endorsement of the company's employees bent on safeguarding their own jobs. And their counter-proposal does not appear to be either making concessions along those lines or presenting alternatives to that aspect of the plan. That's if one source close to the workers has got it right. They do argue, however, that they have a plan they think can work and will try to make that clear to management during Wednesday's meeting. One of the workers' spokespersons has expressed optimism that the ideas will receive a fair hearing. But whether that will stretch far enough to actually displace the Speedwing recommendations is a matter these workers won't have much of a chance to influence further once they've made their case this week. One way or the other, the company will have to come to grips with the recommendations of staff cuts and downsizing in all aspects of Liat's operations. As well-respected journalist Pete Ninval puts it, there will be need for Liat to swallow some bitter medicine. The alternative could be more painful.
Liat may have to prepare for a crash landing.
But that's only if the shareholder governments can't work out mutually acceptable positions on the unresolved issues when they meet in mid-December.
That's Ken Richards reporting. In St. Lucia, there are fears of a bigger split in the banana industry as a group of farmers plan to create a private banana company. The farmers allied to the Banana Salvation Committee say they'll not be selling fruit to the Banana Corporation while Patrick Joseph remains its executive chairman. Mr. Joseph has also been under fire from the finance minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Arnim Eustace, who spoke in St. Lucia yesterday.
Same functions that Webdeco now carries out will have to be carried out by the associations in the individual islands or somebody else. Is it going to be as low a cost as Webdeco did it, or is it going to cost the farmers even more? I want Mr. Joseph to be very careful with what he says. He is misleading the people of the United Islands and the farmers of the United Islands. I am not going to stand by and let that happen.
Arnim Eustace. Malcolm Marshall stood 5 feet 10 inches in his socks, but in the world of fast bowling, he was a colossus. That's just one of the many fulsome and often moving tributes paid to Marshall, who died last Thursday in Barbados at the age of 41. He'd been suffering from cancer of the colon. Bertram Niles has been sampling reaction in the British and in the Caribbean press.
Christopher Martin Jenkins wrote in the Times of London that Marshall was being mourned like no West Indian cricketer since the Frank Worrell. He said the pacer's strike rate made him the most incisive of all the outstanding fast bowlers of his time. Peter Roebuck in the Sunday Times hailed Marshall as the best ever, taking wickets in every country and in all sorts of circumstances. Neither the cold wind of Leeds or the shimmering heat of Ahmedabad could stop him. Vic Marks of the London Observer thought he developed into a great coach and felt that more than any of the other outstanding players of his time, he was the most committed to maintaining his contact with the sharp end in the nets with the next generation rather than the cosy commentary box. The veteran E.W. Swanton wrote in the Daily Telegraph that of the formidable array of modern West Indies fast bowlers, none was faster or more highly rated than Malcolm Marshall. Mark Nicholas, also of the Telegraph, was his friend and captain for many of 11 seasons at Hampshire. He recalled the laughter and the joking in the dressing room. If much of Malcolm characterized the Calypso cricketer, he wrote, much too epitomized the model professional. Marshall was remembered warmly in the Caribbean press. In Guyana, President Jagdeo was the first to put his name into a book of condolences, and Donald Duff of the Daily Starbuck News recalled Marshall telling him he hoped Courtney Walsh broke his record so that he could shake his hand. That's his memory of Marshall. In his native Barbados, the Advocate said it was one of fate's cruel quirks that both West Indies cricket and Marshall appeared simultaneously to be terminally ill. One can only hope, the paper said, that even as he succumbed, the spirit with which he played and distinguished himself in the game will live on to motivate his successors. The Barbados Nation, under the headline Marshall the Magnificent, described him as a national treasure. All West Indies would say a regional treasure. Bertram Niles for BBC Caribbean Report.
And that ends today's edition of BBC Caribbean Report. This is Orin Gordon saying goodbye.